Now, avocados are not new. In fact, they've been around for millions of years, and they were a common part of the diet and cuisine in Mexico and the region before they gained wide popularity here in the U.S. And the avocado has now achieved a kind of rock star status lately in the food world. Excitement about avocados on Vine there. Jeff Miller, an associate professor of hospitality management at Colorado State University, is the author of a new book on the avocado. It's called Avocado, A Global History. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, avocados are big and worldwide now, but where did the kinds of avocado we came to know and love and eat come from?
Well, the avocado's home is in South Central Mexico, in the state of Michoacan, and they have just spread around the Caribbean, down into South America, into America, and then around the world.
Now, we tend to eat them, I think, kind of like a vegetable, but avocados are a fruit, right?
Yeah, avocados are a single seed berry.
They're a berry?
They're a berry. That surprised me, too, when I was doing the research for this book.
Now, we humans like them, but we weren't the first ones to discover the avocado as a food source. You are right that avocados or their ancestors co-evolved with a lot of other big species in the Americas. Who are the animals that helped carry the avocado around?
Well, the avocados were spread by animals that we call the mega herbivores. And mega herbivores are big plant-eating animals. The one that everybody'd be familiar with today would be the elephant. It's this gigantic thing, but it lives entirely on vegetative matter. And in the late Pleistocene, when the avocado was kind of getting its legs, so to speak, the mega herbivores of Mesoamerica were things like the toxodon and the giant ground sloth and the giant armadillo. And somebody once said that the giant armadillo was an armadillo about the size of a UPS truck. So you can get a sense of how big these things were. And they would go around and just swallow. They're so big, they could just swallow an avocado whole and then digest it and then excrete the pit whole and undamaged. And that's how the avocado spread around.
And how big a part of the diet was the avocado for, I guess, pre-Columbian cultures in Central America?
The avocado was very big in these Central American cultures, starting from the very earliest cultures, the Olmecs, the Mayas especially. The Mayas and the Olmecs found out about the avocado, ran onto it very early, and started selecting it very early for size and productivity, and so doing a little bit of crop selection, so to speak. And for the Maya especially, they were very important. They had huge orchards of them. They're so important that they carved them on temples, carved them on graves. They even have a month. The Maya had a 14-month calendar, and one of the months was avocado month. So this is incredibly important for Central American cultures.
Talking to Jeff Miller about his new book, Avocado, A Global History. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you're an avocado fan or an avocado hater. Or if you have a question about how they became such a global phenomenon, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jeff, I want to get into how they became so big here in the United States. There were efforts over a long period of time. But a pivotal moment you describe in your book was when avocado marketers decided that they were going to call this thing an avocado. Talk about that story a little bit.
Yeah, so in 1915, the California Aguacate Association had a meeting in a hotel in Los Angeles. And they had this thing they thought was the next million-dollar idea in food. But they didn't think that anybody would buy it if they called it an aguacate. And this is one of America's less savory historical episodes, unfortunately. There was a lot of anti-Mexican sentiment in Southern California at the time. And in fact, many places, there's a lot of Latinx, anti-Latinx sentiment. So the marketer said, this is a really great thing, but you'll never sell it for big money, make it a premium item if it's associated with Mexicans. And so they put their heads together, did a little research, and found out that the first English settlers in Jamaica called it an avocado or an avocado, and they thought that sounded more sophisticated and more European and continental and less Mexican. And so they just made a vow right there that everybody was going to call it an avocado. In fact, if you called it anything else, like an alligator pear or an aguacate, and you remember the association, you got fined.
And they actually had to pressure the dictionaries of the time, you write, to get them to go with avocado on this.
Yeah, avocado was a new word that nobody really knew, so they had to go sell it to the dictionaries and make very sure that they didn't spell it with an ES, so it's avocados with just an S.
There are a lot of kinds of avocados out there, but today I think if anybody in the U.S. envisions an avocado, they picture the one we call the Haas avocado. Now, the developer of that, I'll ask you to share his story. He was born, though, in Milwaukee before he went on to make his career in avocado production in California. Can you share the story of the avocado that's become the avocado for a lot of us?
Oh, you bet. Yeah. Actually, it's pronounced Haas. Like
Haas. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And you know, for a long time, I had a hard time training myself to say Haas because we've all called it the Haas. But it's a Haas. And yeah, Rudolf Haas was born in Milwaukee. And like so many people in the 1920s, was kind of taken with the lure of California, you know, that land of sunshine, that land of milk and honey. And California was going through that first big citrus boom, and grapefruit and oranges and all these things were coming out of there. So he went out west with his family and got a job with the post office in La Habra, California, and managed to cobble together a little money and decided that he was going to take a chance on these new avocado things that were coming out. And the big avocado of the day was the Fuerte, which was the first cold-resistant avocado. And that was really a big step, finding avocados that could take a little bit of light frost. And so he's got this small orchard of these things, and he's trying to do a little grafting and do a little experimenting with different varieties. And so he buys some rootstock totally anonymously at a nursery and tries to graft on some root, use it for rootstock to graft on some other kinds of avocados. And this one piece of rootstock wouldn't take any grafts. And he even tried to kill it a couple of times. He said, well, if it won't take my grafts, I don't want. He tried to kill it and dig it out. And this was hardy, tough little thing. And eventually his kid said, Dad, don't kill that. That's the best avocados that we have. They're so delicious. And so he tried them and agreed that he thought they were pretty good. And so he started taking them to sell to his friends at the post office and at a local store. Pretty soon they took off, and he thought he had something there, and he did. And he got the Haas avocado was the first patented plant in America. And Haas makes a deal with a nursery to sell these patented plants. Well, growers didn't want to pay $2 or $3 for a Haas avocado start. And so they would buy one or two, and then they would just do what they call evade the patent, essentially steal it. And, you know, the Haas avocado, they said billions of them, billions of dollars worth of them every year. It's the single largest avocado in international trade. And Rudolf Haas never made enough money to quit the post office off of this. And he died about the year the patent expired, and he made about $5,000 on it in his lifetime.
We're talking to Jeff Miller right now, author of the new book, Avocado, A Global History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of avocados? Have you always liked them? Are you a recent convert? Do you have a question about avocados and their history, how they became so big? We'll start taking your calls in just a few moments here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Jeff Miller from Colorado State University, author of the new book, Avocado, A Global History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you pro-avocado? Do you not get the attraction to them? If you love them, how do you eat them? If you have a question about avocados, their history, their production, and more, call in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Caleb is with us in Oconomowoc. Caleb, hi.
Hi, I was just wondering, I've had several people tell me to be wary of purchasing avocados from Mexico due to worker exploitation and like ties to drug cartel. I was just wondering if the speaker could talk about that.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. You do tackle that issue in your book.
Yes, I do. That there are some problems associated with production coming out of Mexico. I personally try and eat mostly American avocados myself, but during one of Mexico's frequent purges, what you might call, during one of their frequent times of pressure on the cartels, some of the cartels down there decided they needed to branch off into legitimate business, although they didn't necessarily get into these businesses legitimately. And so, yeah, some of the avocados that come out of Mexico are fairly well linked to the narcotraficante cartels. And they don't usually run the orchards themselves, but they extract taxes, as they call them, on the production and distribution of the avocados. And so it's, you know, I think in some instances you can definitely say that by buying Mexican avocados that, you know, you are indirectly in some way supporting the cartels. I don't want to make this sound like a blanket statement because there's a lot of good growers down there and there's a lot of good distributors down there. But on the American market end of it, it's kind of hard to tell which avocado is which.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Rachel in West Allis. Rachel, hi.
Hi there. You may have already mentioned it while I was on hold or talking to the representative, but I wanted to say that a couple of years ago, I was going through my great-grandmother's cookbooks, and I found a recipe that referred to an avocado as an alligator pear, and I thought that was just the most fabulous thing ever because it's such a perfect description, and so I think we should call them alligator pears. And then I also wanted... Oh!
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to say that I love avocados or alligator pears, and my favorite ways to eat them are just plain with a little bit of lemon juice and salt, or if you put them in a fruit smoothie, it makes it very rich and creamy, like ice cream.
Rachel, thank you so much for sharing that, and that's a great encounter. Rachel likes the name alligator pear. I do, too, but boy, Jeff, the makers, the people who decided on avocado, the ones trying to sell these things, they hated that name.
Oh yeah, you just made a 1920s avocado marketer roll over in their grave. They said definitely do not call this an alligator pear. They said they don't look like an alligator, which is where I think mostly that term comes from. They said it doesn't look like an alligator. They're not eaten by alligators. There's nothing to do with alligators, and so you shouldn't call them an alligator pear. One of the things that was going on also in the 1920s that I don't think most people think about anymore is alligator was a term from the black jazz community that kind of denoted somebody who was worthless, who was actually a thief. And sometimes when the black jazz musicians would see white jazz musicians in the audience and then hear them use their licks later, they called them alligators. So this whole term alligator was kind of a thief or a worthless person, and the marketers knew that, and they did not want a product that they were getting big money for associated with any kind of reference like that. So, the guy's just rolling in his grave.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard from a bunch of people on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Scott, who says, split it, remove the pit, skin it, and eat. The avocado needs no help from other flavors. It tastes best on its own. Jeff, I think there's probably a divide between people like Scott who want it as is versus a lot of recipes mix it with a lot of different stuff.
Boy, what you mix an avocado with or eat it with is certainly all over the board. Today, you know, of course, the number one way to eat it is probably guacamole. So you've got a lot of sharp flavors in there, the piquant things, you know, like some pepper or some lemon juice or some onion or even some cilantro and things like that, or simple. The second biggest thing is probably avocado toast, or it's really simple. Although I've seen everything from, I like to say everything from anchovies to za'atar on avocado toast. It's all over the board. You know, the classic pairing with it is grapefruit in a salad. And for me, I don't think you can get any more decadent than putting shrimp louis inside an avocado half. That's luxury living for me.
That sounds pretty good. I want to spend our last couple minutes on the future of the avocado, Jeff. You write about sustainability concerns, about threats from a parasite, I think, to the Hass avocado. What are you watching for the future of the fruit?
you know, there's a lot of issues around the fruit. It's getting to be expensive to harvest in the United States. It's kind of a water waster. We think of the almond as a poster child for extravagant water use. It's going to be hard for it to go away. Climate change is going to be a big issue with it. It's already getting too hot in some parts of Australia and South Africa and too dry for it. So the future is tough. There's some other varieties out there that are much more eco-friendly than the Hass, but you know, most people have never heard of them, never seen them. They're green skins, which aren't popular. And to fight some of these things like fungal issues going on and water use and some of that stuff, they're already working on possibly genetically modifying avocados. But most people who eat avocados are want natural foods, back to nature. You know, people want healthful, clean, they want clean labels, right? And so it's going to be hard for the marketers to get us to accept genetically modified avocados. I think the best thing is to try and urge your produce people to bring in some different varieties so people can get used to having different varieties. And different times a year, there's different avocados that could be brought in and could be eaten.
Jeff, thanks a lot for being with us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That's Jeff Miller, Associate Professor of Hospitality Management at Colorado State University and author of the book we've been talking about, Avocado, A Global History. You can still share your avocado thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We had some fans, as I mentioned. We had some non-fans. Andy writes, would love to eat more of them, but I can't get past the texture. Margaret says, I avoid them at all costs. I find them tasteless. The texture is like eating butter. Maybe they're like cilantro, Margaret says, and that 50% of people love them. 50% are like me and find nothing worth eating. Again, share your thoughts on the avocado over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.